Good morning. I am particularly interested in the talk we're about to hear, since I'm a spacey person as well. So I have the privilege of introducing Roger Weems this morning as our plenary speaker. Roger Weems is a scientist at Los Alamos National Laboratory, where he is principal investigator for the ChemCam instrument on the Mars Curiosity rover. He has a BS in physics from Wheaton College and a PhD in physics from the University of Minnesota, Twin Cities. Previously, he was the flight payload lead for the Genesis project, which was the first mission to return to Earth from beyond the moon. In addition to having published his scientific autobiography, Red Rover, he is a contributing author to a recent book that you heard about last night. The book is The Grand Canyon, Monument to an Ancient Earth. In fact, his white paper on the ASA website is the most downloaded document of all time from our website. And that white paper is called Radiometric Dating, A Christian Perspective. Very helpful, thank you. Now, this year, Dr. Weems is the recipient of a very special honor that I just heard about last night from an informant that we're honored to have here, who is his wife, Gwen. And we're honored to have Gwen here with us for the meeting as well. Due to Roger's historic and continuing collaborations with French leaders in space exploration, Roger was knighted by the French government into the Academic Order of the Palms, all right? This chevalier, this order, was started, I believe, by Napoleon. And not very many people from outside France have been granted this honor. So this is a very high honor, and we're very honored for this and many reasons to have Roger here in our presence.
Sir.
Sir. Sir, I don't know how you say that in French. Okay. All right. So Roger will be presenting a talk that I'm sure we're all keen to hear, entitled Exploring Mars with Curiosity, A Scientific and Spiritual Journey. So welcome, Roger, and patience a minute as we get his AV set up here.
Give me a second here. Well, I don't want to hear any night jokes. I will say that actually, when Gwen, who is sitting right down there, heard that I was going to get this, she looked at me and she said, "Well, Roger, it's about time." Now she is, her maiden name is Knight. And so she said, "It's about time, Roger, that you become a knight finally." I think I'm supposed to put this on as well, so I'm going to do that now. And hopefully that is working as well. That is working. All right. Well, let's pray. Let the words of my mouth and the meditation of our hearts be acceptable in your sight, O Lord, our rock and our redeemer. Amen. In the movie The Theory of Everything in 2014, I think we all know about Stephen Hawking, one of the most brilliant minds of our time, and this movie depicts his life, including the fact that he has Lou Gehrig's disease, and one of the themes of the movie, of course, is his triumph in his cosmology and theories and his famous life, in spite of this debilitating disease. But in near the last scene of this movie, they show him giving a question and answer session in the U.S. after the publication of his very famous book, A Brief History in Time. And so the questions are mostly about cosmology and some of the scientific theories. But then, of course, the question goes over to whether he believes in the existence of God. And as he's pondering this question, he sees a pencil drop in the front row. And the movie shows him miraculously getting up out of his chair, walking down, picking up that pencil and handing it to the young woman in the front row. Then the movie snaps back to reality, and the miracle didn't happen, and he is still sitting in his wheelchair, and he is about to answer this question. And so he answers the question saying he doesn't see the need for the existence of God in our universe. Well, my life, I can't say I feel the same way as Stephen Hawking. And while I don't believe in the supernatural, and that I don't believe in magic or, say, gaps in natural history, I can say that I have seen the evidence of God in my life and in our universe in big ways. And so I'm going to talk about some of that this morning. And a lot of what I'm going to talk about is in this book, Red Rover, but I'm going to take you behind the scenes as well, especially to talk about some of the spiritual aspects, as you'll hear in just a little bit. Now, I never expected to go into planetary science. As a kid, I was really excited about rockets and stars and so on. But I actually grew up in a Mennonite community in rural Minnesota. And so if you were to ask me, what are you expecting to do when you grow up, it was probably going to be to go overseas and do some in some way help and serve the needy. And so that was kind of where I was thinking in my life trajectory was going to go. But God kept redirecting me back to the things that I loved. And so I actually didn't get to do these other things going into... After I failed to get into a mission setting in my undergraduate years in college, I just thought, well, I'll go to graduate school. And I know there's a lot of universities overseas that are looking for a professor. So I picked a topic that I didn't think really mattered. So I picked the most interesting topic for my PhD thesis that I could. And that was, in fact, studying meteorites that at that time were just being discovered as having originated on Mars. So we now have in our collections around the world over 150 meteorites that are identified as having come from Mars. You can ask me later about the evidence for that. But I actually got to do the first dissertation on the Mars atmosphere as analyzed in the laboratory, thanks to these meteorites arriving on Earth. So anyway, even after that, I didn't end up overseas. And in fact, little did I know that this actual theme of Mars and analyzing Mars was going to play a huge role in my career. But it took a sudden end of a job to get me into planetary science. And so within, I had just a few days' notice of a job ending, and so I ended up at Caltech working on what became NASA's first robotic spacecraft to return from deep space. I'd had this offer earlier to start working on this, but I turned it down, actually. And so I had to accept it at this point. And so God sometimes just shoves us into the place he wants us, I think. And so this was, of course, exciting for me. And the Genesis mission was designed to capture solar wind, that is, particles or atoms that are streaming outward from the sun, and bring them back to Earth, because we could not study the isotopic composition of the sun, at least not in the accuracy that we use for studies of meteorites and planetary materials. And so this was to accomplish that goal. But there was one spectacular failure in this mission, which did fly, and so from 2001 to 2004, it was out in space, a million miles from the Earth, and this was the first robotic mission to come back from deep space. And so I was in the audience in this crowd at the Utah Test and Training Range in 2004. I was the one assigned to the VIP and press audience here. And this was the hangar from which the helicopters had just vectored out to go and rendezvous with this capsule as it was parachuting down and snag it in midair to protect the fragile contents of this capsule and bring them back down to Earth. Well, so I was sitting in the front row with a Los Angeles Times reporter, and we were watching this on the big screen just a few miles away. And you should have heard the gasp from this audience when this capsule crashed to the ground because the parachute did not open. And so what happened was there was a large reporter from my hometown who knew I was where I was sitting, and he went sprinting to the front row. And of course, all the ABC, NBC, and CBS crews saw that there was somebody who knew their target interviewer, and so there was a media frenzy that followed right after that. And but what they didn't know, and what they didn't actually want to report that day, was that we actually had our samples, and they were on the ground, and there were no human casualties, and we were going to get some science out of this, even though the samples were very broken up. And so there was one instrument in particular that I had been working on, which was to fulfill the highest priority of this mission, and it was basically a solar wind ion telescope, reflecting a telescope that had a little, a small target. Let me grab my laser pointer here. And this this target, right back there, right in the center of this, and the structure had protected this pretty well. And so we extricated that. The analyses took a little bit longer than we expected, but the analyses were made. And in 2011, we actually made the cover of Science magazine with this broken up little target that I had been in charge of developing this instrument. And so we got the isotopic composition of the sun, of oxygen isotopes, nitrogen isotopes, and so on. And we were able to settle some long-standing theories from some people in terms of what some of the meteorite isotopic compositions were telling us about the origin of our solar system and what was going on during that time. And but this kind of spectacular failure in the public's eyes, but actual success in the end, was something that actually came to characterize my career. And so that's what I'm going to talk about. But what that's done is it's given me a deep sense of humility, because I've started to realize that I am not I'm not the one that you can attribute for the success of these things. God is really in control of the history of even the minutiae of these things, let alone bigger things in our solar system and universe. So while I was working on Genesis, I started working with a colleague at Los Alamos to develop a technique for NASA to analyze samples on planetary surfaces. So there's a ubiquitous problem if you want to analyze the rocks and the soils, especially robotically, on another planet or asteroid. And that is, especially if you want to do this remotely or at some standoff distance. And the problem is that everything's covered with dust. And so if you want to analyze that rock, how do you get beneath the dust without actually driving up with the rover and brushing it off somehow, which is mechanically intensive and takes time? And so a colleague had the answer for this, and the answer is that you do it with lasers. And so by using repeated laser pulses that produce a shock wave, you can actually blow the dust away from the sample you want to analyze. And so you can start to analyze things remotely without this dust contamination. It's almost like having a long arm that can reach 20 feet out and brush something off, and then you can analyze it. And so this technique is called laser-induced breakdown spectroscopy, and what we tell the public is that we take a laser pulse with the energy of a million light bulbs, and we focus it down to a spot the size of a pinhead, and then we do that, that pulse that lasts for 5 billionths of a second. So it doesn't take a lot of power from the rover or lander, because it's so short duration, but it ablates material in electronically excited states, and these things are coming off and producing the atomic emission spectra of the elements that are present in the sample that you want, and it can actually profile down a little ways into the sample, and so we can do this at a distance of out to about 25 feet, so to the back of this auditorium almost, and so this was we thought this would be of interest to NASA. And so we put in a small proposal for development of this, and NASA granted us that. And so we worked for several years on trying to get this a small prototype built with commercial off-the-shelf parts that would do demonstrate that this would be really useful on another planet. So we got this onto a NASA rover test bed, as shown here. And the way we did that is we have a small laser that's in this telescope, and then the telescope projects the laser light out to the target. And then the plasma that happens, we get a little bit of that light with this telescope that's still focused on that spot. And then we take that light down with a long fiber optic and down into the body of the rover, and that's where we have the spectrometers that look at the atomic emission spectrum. And we actually used that same architecture eventually for the Curiosity rover. And let's see, I'm going to show that in a short little video here if I don't mess up a punchline. So let's see. Okay, so this should be showing just an animation that shows that this is a point, focus, and shoot technique. So it's very rapid, very easy to do. And then we're going to see the instrument itself. So this is the body unit. This sits inside of the body of the Curiosity rover. Here we have it on our test stand, but these are electronics boards that are sitting in here, and then we have three optical spectrometers that are sitting up here, and you can see optical fiber bundles, three of them right here, that go right into the spectrometers. And then up in the mast of the rover, we have this, and so here is the laser, actually from France, and then there is a telescope right here. And this 4.5-inch diameter telescope is by far the largest optic on the surface of Mars. And in this demonstration, which we did just before we delivered this to NASA, we're going to show what the LIBS plasmas look like. And you won't see the laser beam because the laser is in infrared, so it's invisible to our eyes. But you do see these plasmas. And we're going to focus and do this on an iron pyrite target that's about 8 feet away. And so there is the target, and you'll see a setting up for this, and then you'll see the little plasmas. And there they are. And these are optically bright, so you can see that even in broad daylight, we can do this out to some distance. And so when the launch happened and the media started focusing on this mission, and when we were getting close to the landing, the media started getting interested in this. Now, this is a one-ton rover, and so they thought, oh, this is really appropriately equipped with this laser gun. And we started doing some interviews and telling them how we zap rocks on Mars. It makes a little zapping sound. But you know how the media is. They always tend to make things a little bigger. And so they started saying we're blasting rocks on Mars. Well, that makes a little different connotation. And maybe especially with the idea that we were from Los Alamos, maybe worse. And so upon landing, we actually found this picture in the internet. So we assure people that we did not do this kind of environmental damage. But getting back to this test in the desert in Nevada that was actually years before this, I was so excited to have this test happening. I thought maybe this is the ticket to actually getting us on a rover to going to Mars. And so I was looking forward to this so much. And yet the very week that we were supposed to go out to Nevada and do this test, there was a huge wildfire in my hometown, Los Alamos. And it destroyed some 200 structures, and the whole county was evacuated. And so I had the choice, do I go out here, abandon my family, or if we're doing this thing that I really love, or do I stay with my family? And I chose the latter. And so my wife is still with me. But it's very disappointing, of course, to miss that. But NASA started paying more attention in spite of that to what we were doing. But the road to Mars is really fraught with politics. And that's bad news for me because I'm terrible at politics and I hate politics. And so this is really, I guess, an area where I just really felt like God was, again, doing his thing behind the scenes. And we, you know, because I didn't envision myself as being a leader of an instrument like this at all in the future. And so there's a number of things that of course, happened that almost completely prevented this from happening, from us getting to Mars. But one of the first was that after this test, my colleague, he started to actually start doing things without me, and so we looked like maybe our partnership was going to end. This was very disturbing to me because I love this kind of thing so much, and I just thought we were bound to do this together. And so I was pretty eaten up about that, but I decided we would get a mediator and try to work things out. So we sat down and talked together. At first that went okay, and then it went terribly badly. And but then in the end with the mediator, we ended up trying to work things out and make things work together. But I was very disturbed by this. I knew that people were going to try to defeat us right and left, because there are so many other competing ways, instruments that would like to get on a Mars rover. And yet this was kind of biting us even before we got into the competition. But in worship, of course, and in my private life, I was praying about this a lot. And one of the Sundays that this was happening, I just as I was in church, I just felt as if God was saying to me, you won't always be working with this colleague. And I thought, well, you know, we rationalize what we sometimes feel like God is telling us. And I thought, well, yeah, this colleague will probably retire before I do. But we went on and we did work together. But I took a mental note of that. What actually happened was that we started to develop this proposal for the Mars rover. So NASA has just announced these plans for what became the Curiosity rover, and we were going to have to go into a competition for the payload. And in the end, there were 49 proposals, and only a few were selected, so you can tell what the competition was like. But the history of these rovers on Mars is started in 1997. It had been 20 years since the Viking landers, and so there had been 20 years with nothing on Mars. And then this small little rover called Sojourner, which you could have held in your arms, but it was successful enough that it told NASA they really wanted to do more of this, and so they sent Spirit and Opportunity in 2004 that landed. These were extremely successful, and one of them is actually still operating on Mars in spite of the fact that they were designed for 90 days. But the problem in our minds were that these rovers only could hold about 15 pounds of payload. And that's good for a camera and just a few other very small things. And so the science community longed for the day when we could have something like a mobile laboratory on Mars. We really wanted to get back to understanding, are there organic materials on Mars, and what is the environment really like, and so on. So that's how we got our wish with this Curiosity rover, which is a one-ton rover, the size of your car, and the arm of this rover weighs as much as a previous generation of rover, Spirit and Opportunity. So this one is huge by comparison. It had 160 pounds of payload of scientific instruments. And the goals of this mission were to assess the biological potential of Mars, to characterize the geology of the landing region, and to study the past habitability of Mars and look for human hazards. Especially this idea of habitability is a curious one. Mars is a sister planet to the Earth in many ways. It has 1/10 the mass of the Earth, but there's 38% of the Earth's gravity on the surface of Mars. But what's happened is, with the lack of a magnetic field and this lower gravity on Mars, most of the volatiles have been lost from Mars over time, including the atmosphere and the water that isn't frozen. And so there's been a tremendous change on Mars over time. So the real question is, was Mars ever like this? Was it ever very Earth-like and habitable, the kind of place where you would expect microbes to exist, and so on? And part of the question driving this is whether is how life was started on Earth, and whether we might find life on Mars as well. If we look at the geologic history of Mars, most of Mars is very ancient, and so that actually there's a global dichotomy across along the equator, such that the southern hemisphere is mostly very ancient. And so this is the Noachian period. I don't know if you can see that very well, but it dates to about 4 billion years ago. And then the northern hemisphere, which is more featureless, dates to a bit younger in the Hesperian. And then there's a few volcanic terrains that date to younger times than that. In fact, Mars is still potentially volcanically active today. But if we look at this in comparison to the Earth's development over time, that it appears that water existed on the Earth already over 4 billion years ago, and the first life on Earth is supposed to have been identified as over 3.3 billion years ago. But if you try to study that life on Earth, it's extremely difficult because the rocks have been heavily metamorphosed, and the subduction plates on the Earth have brought most of the ancient crust down back into the mantle. So how do we look for and study and try to understand early life? Well, one way is potentially to go to Mars and try to understand if Mars had life, what did it look like in comparison to Earth? Now, you might be thinking, well, what if God only created life on Earth? Well, remember that we have 150 meteorites from Mars that are here on Earth. And so it's very, very likely that over time, over geologic history, there were a lot of rocks from Earth that have been blasted off of the surface of Earth by large impacts. Those probably contain microbes of some primitive form, and they would have flown around in space, and some of them would have landed on Mars, potentially seeding Mars with life. So even if life was only started on Earth, there's a good chance we would still find it on Mars. And so this is what's driven a good amount of our study of Mars, trying to understand this as well as to really understand what went on Mars as a planet. But anyway, so we did over that year work on and develop our own proposal for the Mars rover. The proposal cover looks like this. And so we showed how we could do two techniques. One is the elemental compositions at a distance and potentially in locations where the rover could never actually reach itself with its arm. And then also give close-up images through that telescope as well. And like I said, some 49 proposals were submitted, and only a few would be chosen. And my partner and I worked reasonably well over the course of this year, but God directs the times and the seasons of our lives and what happens. So there was something kind of tumultuous that happened next. And so the day that this proposal arrived in Washington, just after we had finished it, there was an accident in a laser lab. And my colleague had been doing some other experiments with a student, and I knew nothing about these. Again, it was maybe a bit behind my back. And they were actually not wearing their laser goggles as they were working. And so the student was directed to look in one direction and sustained laser damage to her eye. And this was the last straw in a long string of several security and safety incidents in our whole national laboratory. And the director actually asked everyone to stand down for a whole month and just work on safety, and my partner was fired. And I had to realize that this was almost exactly a year to the day that I thought I'd heard that I wouldn't always be working with my partner. And my jaw kind of just dropped to the ground and stayed there for many days, because you hear about these things happening, in Bible times and so on, something like Ananias and Sapphira. But this was modern time. This was somebody that I was working with, and it was like a lightning bolt had hit very close to me, and it's like, what was going to happen next? But actually, what did happen next was that our proposal was selected by NASA, and of all things, out of the 49. Proposals, and I got a call from NASA headquarters and emails from congressmen, and I would be leading an instrument to go to the surface of Mars. And so once again, the book Red Rover chronicles a number of the technical challenges we faced, and in developing a new technique, and it was immature, and so it was actually we're going to have to do more things to develop this than we thought. And in fact, the whole rover was quite a stretch in terms of technology, not just because of the size, but because of the instruments. There were 10 instruments on this rover. Many of them were new technology, and so it took us quite a lot to get off the ground. JPL was managing us, and they told us to add a number of more system engineering, more management, and they were worried about the weight of this one-ton rover, and so they asked us to build our instrument, or major part of it, out of beryllium, which is very expensive, which we had not been planning to do, so for $500,000 more we did that. And so the cost started to mount, but these were all in agreement with what we were doing with JPL, except we also had some other issues, and so we were beginning to be maybe about $1 million over, but that's not that much. There were some other instruments that were, say, about $20 million over at that stage. So things were actually starting to come together. It was the summer of 2007. And this is me with my instrument manager, and we're developing this getting towards the final stages, or what we thought were the final stages. But something else happened here. A new administrator came into NASA as the associate administrator, and this was a person who really wanted to change the course of NASA in a big way, and he was not a fan of Mars. And so he was also very, very strong on trying to cut some costs. And so the Curiosity rover actually went on the chopping block at this time. And so we didn't know what was going to happen. He was decreeing that something would have to probably give. And now, when you have large spacecraft, at least sometimes in the past, these, especially say ones that are going far out to the outer solar system or someplace, they will sometimes have quite unrelated instruments, some working on one thing, some working on another, that may not be that related. But on a Mars rover, many things are actually interrelated in how you develop the architecture of that payload. And so I kind of, some of the aspects I show this way, a bit like a funnel. You have some measurements that are rapid, that can be done quickly and analyze a lot of things to try to find the best samples for techniques that take a long time. And that's actually very true for this particular rover. And so just to illustrate that, this is where we were with after about 2 years into the mission. The ChemCam instrument had taken about 260,000 spectra. On the arm of the rover, we have another instrument that does chemistry that had taken about 200 measurements. And then the instruments that are sitting inside the rover that require powder to be fed to them into a funnel on the top of the rover, they had made about 8 measurements. And you can imagine that and those measurements take about a week to make. And so you can imagine that if you were to try to make these complicated, time-consuming measurements on every sample, you wouldn't get very far. And so this is the kind of architecture, and it's why we have these synergistic measurements that we make on our rover. But this was all kind of lost on this NASA administrator. He was going to cut something. And I didn't really think it was going to be us. We had a very, very small overrun. One of the only instruments that was not being built at a NASA center. And sometimes those politics play a role. But anyway, so on September 11, that is 9/11, 2007, I got a call from NASA headquarters telling me that, Roger, I have bad news for you. NASA is not going to fund your instrument anymore from here on. And it's like, you've got to be kidding. So they had made the decision, and then they had to justify it, and often this is done in a backhanded way, hopefully not very often, but what happened was that then we had to be kind of bad-mouthed in order to justify this decision, and so our institution, myself personally, and the instrument that we were developing were all severely criticized in order to justify this. And so not only did we have a powerful NASA administrator against us, but now we have the media against us. And so our $1 million overrun turned into being responsible for most of the overrun of the whole rover. And so, because part of it is not that the media often feeds on itself. Remember the illustration that I just showed earlier? So that's sometimes what happens. And so we'd become the sacrificial lamb in this sense. And I just really felt like I was a little boy, David, fighting a huge giant, Goliath. And there was, this was not something very easy to do at all. And I knew that I couldn't do it in my own strength. We did a few things, of course. We started by trying to correct the misconceptions that were out there, first with the science community, so that we told them what our actual Oberon was and what was the importance of our instrument. And then once they were energized, we started a letter and email writing campaign. And so the NASA administrators got several thousand emails within the course of a few days. And I also went to the NASA advisory panels, part of the National Academy panels that advise NASA. They were strongly recommending that this instrument get restored to the rover. So we did all of that. Nothing happened. And so inside I was very numb. I just didn't know what was going to happen. And it seemed to me as if this was a project personally that had been given to me in sort of a miraculous way. And in spite of the things, the fierce competition and all, and yet it felt like it was just absolutely being taken away. And I just felt like Abraham walking up to Mount Moriah with his son. And I'm a worship leader in our church. And so at this time, I was the main keyboard player or piano player every Sunday. And I remember vividly singing words like, "Blessed be your name when I'm found in a desert place. You give and take away. You give and take away. And yet my heart will choose to say, blessed be your name." And so I'd be sitting at the piano. Fortunately, I wasn't doing vocals because tears were streaming down my face. And, you know, God will do this for us sometimes. And it's a powerful lesson. And I'm actually glad that he does that. Then, one day in November, 2 months after the cancellation was announced, I got an email from NASA that was congratulating me for cutting costs and telling us that we were back on the rover. And they were going to give us $500,000 and declare victory, and that was it, nothing more, and we'd have to make it work. So, okay, well, we tried, but we were in a bad way. We lost some team members. We were trying to get back going, and we ran into just a few more difficulties. And so our delivery to NASA had to get delayed a little bit longer, and NASA could see kind of the success fading again of this project. And so what were they going to do? So they decided to do what they usually do, which is convene a review. And so they called a review panel. They actually had the review panel come to Los Alamos so that we didn't have to spend any money to travel on our very slim budget at this point. We actually had a broken piece, a piece of beryllium that was broken that we glued together to put back into our instrument because we couldn't buy any replacements by this time, something that's completely unheard of. So this review panel was coming just at a time when NASA announced that the whole rover project was actually needing more money as well. And so there was even talk of possibly shutting down the twin MER rovers, Spirit and Opportunity, on Mars in order to fund this new cost overrun for the rover as a whole. And so in this kind of scenario, the review came, the panel was chaired by, of all people, a former boss of the NASA administrator under whose thumb we were. And so this panel chair told us that basically unless we got more funds, or actually unless this administrator was replaced, we would not get any more funds. And unless we got more funds, we would likely fail. But they went through their review and they placed the chances of success statistically at 29%. And personally, I didn't know what was going to happen next. You know, we'd been through so much already. And I'm just going to read from my book here on this last kind of scenario. So once again, our backs were to the wall. There was nothing we could do to fix the situation. I was praying desperately that something would happen. Little did I know how soon relief would come. That week turned out to be quite eventful in Washington. News that the twin merge would be shut down touched off a wave of protest among the science community. And apparently, Dr. Stern had gone too far. Late the next day, there was a rumor afloat that he would step down. I couldn't believe it. But an official announcement came the next day, and the day after that, I got a call announcing ChemCam's full funding would be restored. And so we never went through dark days like that again. It was amazing that we managed through that. And we were able to finish the instrument and get it onto the rover. But one of the enduring side effects of this cancellation is that people really thought we were the bad guys, especially me. And so once the NASA leadership changed, we were actually, one of the things we immediately did was to send a correction to the media. And so Science Magazine received our correction, and they investigated the issues, and they were very happy to print the correction. And then at Los Alamos, the upper management, they kind of knew that we had been a complete political football in this thing, and so they didn't look at me so much. The people who were working right around me knew who I was, but the middle management, they somehow didn't get in on any of this. And even after the launch, our division leader told me to my face, he said, you have the worst managed project in the history of the division. And there were people telling other people that it would be a career-ending move to start to work on my project. So talk about humility. We have to really live it sometimes when things like this happen. And you know, after the landing happened, just a few months later, the lab director was asking me to go around and give talks. I was able to give this bumper sticker, "My other vehicle zaps rocks on Mars," to the Secretary of Energy. So this bumper sticker looks good around the Washington Beltway. And things like that. I gave a personal briefing to Bill Gates and his son and so on. But you know, coming from that kind of place makes you realize that this isn't me who's doing this, that things are very, very far beyond my control. And so that was those were all very, very good lessons to learn. Now we were able to start really focusing on where we are going with this rover and this instrument. And so this is the globe of Mars with the previous landings. And there was quite some discussion among the science community, which was actually open to helping us decide where to land this rover. And so we had some real good choices. This is Eberswalde Crater, and it shows a Mars River Delta. And you can see in the sediments, the meanders. And so this would certainly be a great place to look for evidence of water and habitability. But we thought we had an even better place, and that is Gale Crater. And so Gale Crater is this 90-mile wide crater near the equator, and it is the deepest place for about 1,000 kilometers around. Now remember that if we look at this map once again, the southern hemisphere is all pockmarked with craters, and it's a highlands area, almost like a supercontinent, but there's no plate tectonics on Mars. And in the northern hemisphere is lowlands, and so you see a lot of flow channels heading to the north. And Gale Crater is no exception to that. And so at the southern end here, you can see these gullies going into the crater. And then we have this mountain in the middle, which is a sedimentary mound of material. And we didn't know how that was produced. But what we saw is at the base, there were orbital spectroscopy, it looked like there were clays near the base of this mountain, and then some sulfates. And so what we thought is that by driving up this mountain, the lower part of this mountain, we would be able to see the transition in climate between a wet, warm Mars, if it ever was that way, to a dry and cold place. And so the first goal was to establish there was water in this place, and then secondly, to try to understand what happened. And so the landing was successful and put us in this place right here, which we named after Ray Bradbury, Bradbury Landing. This is the Mount Sharp right here, 3 miles high. And in between, you can see a dark line of sand dunes. And we landed on this alluvial plain of gravel, and we set about to studying what we could find there. ChemCam went to work, and this is one of the first types of measurements we did, which was to study the soils. And one of our first discoveries is that the soils are hydrated. We didn't know that, but there's a hydrogen atomic emission line that we could easily study and look at that. This is on a slope. This is a time lapse that we took with ChemCam, but we took the pictures after every laser shot. You're not actually seeing the plasma because they're not happening simultaneously. And then we put this little video together. This is on a slope, and so the soil that is coming out of the hole here is actually going downhill and all falling down there. You can probably see that. And then we were able not only to show that the soil is hydrated, but we were able to study the differences between the coarse grains, which are actually feldspar-like, or mostly feldspar in this picture, to the fine grains. And that went into Science magazine. Then in terms of the rover as a whole, we started driving along. We drilled a couple of holes to show the mineralogy was that of a freshwater lake with saponite clays. And then as we drove along, we started seeing more and more of these kind of terrains. We saw, in fact, these dipping beds over a period of about 9 kilometers. And they're dipping downwards all in the same direction. And there's two ways you can make sandstones that are tilted. One is by plate tectonics, if the tectonics starts to tilt things over, but again, Mars doesn't have much of that. The other way is to produce these beds on a sloping area, on a slope. And if you look at this closely, and you may not see this real well, but you have a fine grain material up here, and you have coarse grain material, and a lot of these are alternating coarse and fine grains. And what happens if you are on a deltaic area, like is shown in this caricature, is that if the lake level is varying, at times you're going to have the coarse grains, which are going to settle out near the edge of the river, near the edge of the lake, and at times you're going to have fine grains, which are in suspension longer, that go further down. So if this lake level is actually fluctuating up and down, you're going to get those interlayering of fine and coarse grains. That's exactly what we saw. And they're on a slope, and so this must have been a very large lake that was varying its lake levels over large periods of time, because we're seeing this over 9 kilometers. And so we showed this kind of image to the public to show what we thought Mars looked like at some point in the past, this being Gale Crater. Now we could map from orbit some of the different terrain nearby. And so, I'm sorry about the small size of this. The rover is at the star down there. This is the edge of the crater, and what we could see is a valley that was coming down from the rim of the crater, and there's actually a catchment basin here. So if there was precipitation on Mars, it would flow down this valley, brought all of this material down into this alluvial fan where we were. And so what we found rounded pebbles, which means that this material was sloshed around in a stream for kilometers. And then we also found these kind of conglomerates, which are things that you produce in a river environment. So they're cemented clasts that are cemented together by the precipitation of material in this mud on the side of a river. Now this one I'm showing in particular because of this nice feldspar-rich clast right here. Now on Mars, the conventional wisdom has always been that Mars is a basaltic planet. That is, it consists of olivine-rich kind of dark rocks that, compared to Earth, they would be the type of rocks that we have in the ocean basins. And we knew that Mars didn't have plate tectonics, so maybe that's somewhat logical. But what we're seeing here is a lot of lower density minerals. In fact, we saw some rocks that had up to 80% feldspar. And this is the kind of thing that you would find in, say, the San Gabriel Mountains on continents. And so we're starting to put together a story where it looks as if, and we published this in Nature Geoscience last year, where it looks as if the southern hemisphere of Mars may have either in large part or at least partially these lower density materials that were never thought to have been on Mars before. And so this is an important discovery we made as well. And let's see, I guess there's my words. We found some interesting things on Mars. This is a meteorite that we found that we drove past, and so meteorites fall on Mars as well. Then in terms of things like the organic measurements, this is done by the SAM instrument and out of Goddard. And what we saw, this instrument sniffs the atmosphere as well as looks for organics in this drill samples. And so this is showing some some perhaps a periodic or local methane releases into the atmosphere. And if we look at that on a longer time scale, it looks like we have these big releases kind of falling on top of more of a sinusoidal seasonal pattern of methane. And we don't know what's causing the methane on Mars. It could either be microbes or organics underground that are decaying and producing this, or it could be simply weathering of some rocks underground in the presence of carbon. And so the jury's still out on that. Now, Curiosity also found organics. And this is an organic molecule that is not particularly savory. It is a chlorobenzene, but we know that the, and so it's seen here in one drill hole represented by green, but there is another drill hole that was just a few meters away that didn't have it, so we don't understand some of that. We do know that the Mars atmosphere, or the Mars environment is not very conducive to organics. You have a lot of perchlorates in the soil that will tend to break down organics, and even if not in the soil or the sediments, the oven of the SAM instrument starts to heat things up, and the first thing it does is produces oxygen, and then you can actually pyrolyze the or burn off some of the organics before they're actually analyzed in the instrument. And so the real question is, how much organics is there that we're actually not seeing? And so the jury is out on that as well. And of course, we don't know that organics means life. They're organic molecules of random chirality in meteorites, and they will fall to Mars as well. But so there has to be more experiments to try to understand what this really means. Now, in the last year, we've come across this line of sand dunes on Mars, and so this has been a fun thing to study. This is a dune called the High Dune, and this is at least about 40 feet deep here, we think. So this shows a traverse of the rover, and I don't know if you can see it very well, but we first drove up last November to this high dune and came along to, this would be the windward side, and then we came along to the lee side of this Namib dune right here. And now these dunes are actually known to be advancing on Mars. From the satellite data, they're shown that they're moving about 1 foot per year. And we didn't leave the rover long enough there to get any kind of worries, of course, but we did come up close to this steep side of the dune and really wanted to see, and we could see for ourselves that this dune was actually advancing. Over the course of a week, we could actually see a little bit of motion, and you can see, I'm sorry about the small size, but there are some areas where there are grain flow, and you could see avalanches that are coming down. So this was moving along. And here's the picture, the kind of microscopic picture of the sand. And this is kind of a green sand, and that's because, actually, even from orbit, there were indications of a mineral olivine. And if you've been on the Big Island in Hawaii, there are some olivine beaches there. But the question is, why olivine? Because all along our rover traverse up to this point, we have not seen any olivine minerals. And so that kind of brings a new mystery of, how are these grains, which are almost a good fraction of a millimeter, how did they get where they are? They could have traveled many kilometers, and so maybe the Mars wind, even though we have such a thin atmosphere, is a bit surprising. I'm going to tell you about one other problem we had with the ChemCam instrument and how that came to resolution. In November of a year and a half ago, we were tooling along just happily doing our job when we had a failure. And the instrument works in such a way, first of all, the rover has to work robotically. We only send commands up to the rover once a day, and it operates all day by itself, or even over the weekend or a holiday, so that it's working more than we are. So we have to focus this telescope on whatever targets we pick. We have to do that robotically as well. It has to do that autonomously. And so what we do to focus the telescope is we have a little laser, diode laser. It's almost like this laser pointer, almost exactly. Sits right in the middle of our telescope, and we turn that on, and then there's a sensor at the back of the telescope that is tuned to this laser frequency, and we scan the focus stage, and we get a curve of the light through that, and the instrument itself can find the peak and then command the telescope to go back to where that is maximized. And so that's how we focus. Well, wouldn't you know it, over a period of a few days in November of 2014, that darn little laser pointer just copped out. And so it's like, we're left high and dry, what are we gonna do? Well, it turns out that ChemCam also takes these images, And so we started thinking about how if we could get the instrument to analyze the images to figure out which image is in focus, take a series of images at different focus planes and then figure out which one's in focus, it could do the same thing with images. So we worked on this algorithm, we tested it out in France, in Los Alamos, in Jet Propulsion Laboratory, and then we finally sent it to Mars after 6 months of development. And this is one of the few repairs you can do on Mars. Although the hardware failed, we were able to do a software fix for it. And thank God we had a versatile instrument. And so with that, we were able to get this working again. And this was a blessing in disguise. And so while the laser pointer would only work to about 50 feet away, this new way of focusing using images could work to anywhere you could take a picture, right? And so now we were able to start doing a campaign of long-distance imaging with ChemCam. Most of the images that are long-distance on the rover are taken by MastCam. And so in the background here is a MastCam image. I'm not sure if it's clear from back where you are, but when we overlay ChemCam pictures on there, we get a much clearer view. And so we started doing some long-distance imaging in the last year doing this, and it's been very fruitful. Now, in terms of where the rover is, we started out in the low part of the crater where it was safer to land, did our investigations of the water and the sandstones there, and then we drove along, tried to skirt the dunes, and then we got to the edge of the dunes here this last November, and now we've turned the corner and we're sort of starting to go on our way up into this outrageous terrain right here where you have this huge flow channel. But already a couple of years ago, we saw a problem with the rover, and that is that the wheels were made as lightweight as they could be. They're actually made out of aluminum because rubber doesn't work in another planet. And we started seeing that these wheels were getting punctured. So you can see a little bit of light through there. And so the rover people at JPL started getting quite worried that the wheels were going to limit our life. Well, we did actually divert and drive on a little bit more softer terrain whenever we could. Did a few other things to try to minimize that. And we don't think the wheels are going to hurt us too badly at this point. This is the spring. You can see that they are considerably more bummed up, but we've gone another 5 kilometers. But the nice thing is that none of the support structure, these drowsers, have failed yet, knock on wood. And so we think that we have another 8 or 10 kilometers left to go with this rover. So it looks like we'll probably get up into this gully. By that, we would have gone past the clay layers that are seen from orbit and up into the sulfates. So that would really fulfill our mission. And we're pretty excited about that. Now, one final chapter is when NASA saw how successful this was in the public eyes in 2012, they announced that they wanted to do another rover. So that sounded great. Well, I was having a lot of fun myself with doing things on Mars, and it's like, I don't know if we want to do this again. I really did feel like this was something that I should do, and after prayer. And so we did work on a proposal, but NASA always has a science definition team define what the new mission should do. And this definition team was packed with mineralogists and spectroscopists, and so they were not the people who do the chemistry like our instrument does. And so they decreed that the remote sensing instrument on this new rover should actually do mineralogy. And maybe they thought they were rid of us. But actually, with our team, we were able to develop an instrument that actually added 2 new techniques. Both of which cover mineralogy, and so this is Raman spectroscopy, and this is visible and infrared reflectance spectroscopy. And so we took the same architecture of instrument and added these 2 new techniques. And when the new rover payload was announced in 2014, NASA said that this is a Swiss Army knife type of instrument where it can do so many different things. And this rover is going to actually collect samples for future return to Earth. It's going to do that with drill cores and just drop them in a location for pick up by another mission. It's going to demonstrate production of oxygen for future astronauts and explore a new area of Mars. So it's gonna do a lot of exciting things. And unfortunately for me, I now have two jobs, running ChemCam and in helping develop this new instrument. But so far we're surviving, so thank God. I'm gonna skip a few things here and just go to one final thing. We'll skip Matt Damon and just talk about the fact about one enduring aspect of this, and that is the landing. So my previous this is a conference on the mind and how, and one of the things is just how profoundly we are affected by our previous experiences, right? And so this was my previous experience of a landing, and but nobody else had this kind of experience when it came to the main people on Curiosity. And so when we came to the night of the landing, it was pretty much a party atmosphere. But you know, I was kind of sitting there going, well, it's going to go this way, it's going to go that way. You know, knowing that this simple system where we had just an accelerometer and a mortar to go wrong, compared with a complicated rover descent, which has 76 pyrotechnic devices that all have to go off just exactly on time, left me with a profound fear that this was just not going to work out right. And so I'm gonna end with this landing sequence, and we'll just show you what it was like. And there is some sound with this. I'm gonna pull this down just a little bit and see if we can hear that as well. So this first of all shows the animation. But we had an animation for the Genesis mission as well, and it didn't help it turn out right. but this time it did. And so we're going to show the animation, and then we're going to show the real thing. And the real thing includes a descent video, and that descent video is synced up with the sounds from Mission Control, even though Mission Control couldn't really see this video at the time. So here's the capsule is larger than Apollo, that brought people to the moon. This is still plummeting to the ground because of the thin atmosphere of Mars, even with the parachute. And so we had to have the sky crane actually do the landing. And then the next question was, how do we get the retro rockets off of the rover? And so they decided to lower the rover on cables, this harebrained scheme, and deploy the wheels at the very last minute. And so there it goes. And then the cables get cut, and the sky crane goes and flies away. So now we're going to watch the actual video, but like I said, the people in Mission Control couldn't see this. They had only a few bits of data back from the rover. So there goes the heat shield. You can see the sand dunes down there on the ground. And so it's now on parachute. And then we're gonna kind of quickly cut over to the sky crane mode here. So, so this is the sky crane part of it. And the first thing that happens is that the sky crane diverts so that it doesn't get tangled with a parachute that is still plummeting down. And so it goes off to the side here. I'm sorry you can't see this real well, but and then it's going to kind of straighten out. You're going to start to see the dust getting kicked up. And so there it goes, straightens out. And then as it starts to play out the rover on the cables, you'll actually see one of the wheels deploy, and it's going to be up on this side here. And there it goes. So the wheel, at least one wheel, is looking good. And then as it gets real close to the ground, unfortunately this gets dark from the shadow of the rover and with all the turbulence going on. It's just about to land right here. And when the dust clears, you'll actually see a few pebbles on the ground right about in there. If you can. Yeah, I think that's, so it's actually landed here, but the team is counting to 10 to make sure the sky crane doesn't crash on top of it. So they're getting excited, but they're not ready for success yet. 8, 9, 10. There you go. So that was an exciting night. And I'm just going to leave with that. Thanks.
Worthy of being Sir Roger Wing's knighted for this. potential new rover as well. So I think we have time for just a couple of questions. So do we have a couple of burning, oh, we have 5,000 questions. All right, how am I going to do? All right, how about Bill Newsom? Does he need to come up to the mic, or can
I? I think I'm fine. I really am interested in how popular culture shapes major national science projects, both positively and negatively. Now, I'm very curious about whether the Martian, the movie, whether you guys felt any impact of that inside of NASA, or whether it was you just were doing your thing and it was just total ripple.
Okay, so Bill has asked, he says he's very interested in how popular culture shapes both positively and negatively these missions, and he's asking about the Martian and how that is affecting our ideas for Mars exploration. Is that right?
Well, you're just whether it's supported, whether you saw a surge of support in Congress and the public, or whether it was just really had no effect.
So we did see a huge amount of interest in the movie The Martian, and I think that has strongly supported what NASA wants to do. Yes, I agree.
Incidentally, we had a talk where I work at Goddard Space Flight Center from the leader of the Planetary Science Division, who came and talked to us about what things they consulted NASA about for that movie and what things were creative license.
This is a very quick question. On a scale from just meh to very yes, how convinced are you that there was flowing water on Mars or something, flowing liquid water?
How convinced was I that there was flowing water on Mars before the mission? Or now and after? There's no doubt that there was flowing water on Mars after the mission. I think before the mission, we knew that there was some water that was existing on the surface, maybe brackish water, and maybe only very ephemerally, or maybe under a coat of ice. But now we know it must have been an open lake and had rivers, and these rounded, even just the evidence from rounded pebbles means that these rocks, which start out very angular, must have been tumbled for some kilometers, and we can even give estimates of how far they've gone.
Okay, so, this is so hard.
Not very many people were here.
One more question.
How about Ruth? Okay.
At the same time that our son was getting dressed up as opportunity for Halloween in around, I guess, 2005, he was also planning a trip to Europa. And so we want to know, where are you going next?
NASA going next? Well, of course, so I've talked about the future missions to Mars, but of course NASA is interested in many places. We are interested in potentially a lander on Venus. There's also a planned mission to the surface of Europa, and so your son would be very interested in that. But it's a kind of hellish place to be with a huge radiation dose around Jupiter and a very cool place to be. So that would be a very short-lived mission, but it is being planned. In terms of other missions, there are ideas to go back to the moon. And then NASA also wants to, with the human exploration, bring part of an asteroid closer to Earth so that we can take the Orion craft and go out there and then maybe eventually go to, say, the moons of Mars, which you can reach without having to have a rocket builder on the surface of Mars, and maybe someday land on Phobos or Deimos. So some of those things are all in mind, and there's many, many other things as well.
Yeah. Let's think.